whatever we do as Christians, God is working out his redemptive purposes through our activities, including our economic activities, as insignificant or significant as they might be. So whether you are buying a pack of gum, you are saving for retirement, budgeting, coming up with your family budget, the type of money you use, all of these economic decisions, choreography that plays out in our lives, we either conflict with or contribute to God's redemptive purposes. And that's where my heart was pricked, as I mentioned, with the entrepreneurial call that God has placed on our hearts, that we are called to more than just, you know, be dependent on the nanny state or become a 9-to-5 wage slave. We're called to more. Hey folks, welcome back to the Throwing Mountains podcast, where men are rediscovering courageous leadership. You are going to be strengthened from the stories of God working in the lives of ordinary men today. Men who become leaders in their spheres of influence by relying on God and following Jesus. Welcome. We're really, really grateful you're here with us. My name is Mike Hatch. I am your host, and I am joined, as usual, by my co-host, Chris Bollinger. And we're really glad you chose to be with us, especially if you're here for the first time. A special welcome to you. Grateful that you chose to be with us today. Now, today's episode is going to be a little different, I guess. A couple episodes ago, we released an episode that I produce for a local podcast that I'm working on here in Pittsburgh called Redemptive Economics. And part of the reason was because a lot of listeners are from Pittsburgh. And so we definitely wanted to give you folks a chance to check it out. Even though it's focused on Pittsburgh, the principles do definitely transcend to other places as well. So I could see people globally being interested in the content, of course. But today we wanted to take a chance and do a switcheroo and let Chris interview me about this project of redemptive economics. And so with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to you, Chris, and try to sit back and play a different role today.
You're the host and guest. Take it away. So that's right. Wearing multiple hats as you normally do. Yeah. Well, I really wanted to do a deeper dive on redemptive economics after your fairly brief podcast episode a couple weeks ago. So yeah. I'm very interested in the topic, and you kind of wet my whistle with that short episode.
Yeah.
But before we get into the details of redemptive economics and why everybody listening should care about this and should be thinking about how to change their decisions and actions based on these principles, I want to know what captivated you about this topic. What made you passionate about redemptive economics?
So we go back to 2007, 2008. Well, actually, even somewhat before that, when I was even in college, I just had an interest in finances, being responsible financially, saving, investing. I remember when I was 21, I went to my bank and started an IRA to hopefully start saving for the future. But it was interesting. I do remember at that time being disappointed because I went to the bank to meet with the financial advisor there, and I was expecting an education. I was expecting, hey, these are the options, and we're going to meet on a regular basis, and I'm going to help train you so that you can learn how to invest and deal with money and stuff. But that was not it at all. He just basically said, yeah, you're 21. You've got a lot of years ahead of you. Let me start you on an IRA and go ahead and start putting money in the IRA on a regular monthly basis and you'll be fine. Like, oh, okay. That's it. Like that, nothing else. So it was a little disappointing, but I did start to learn more. I went through different education classes similar to the Dave Ramsey Financial Peace class. And my wife and I started out very much trying to budget, be responsible, save, all that kind of stuff. And so I'm grateful for that. But then 2007, 2008 hit. And that was an eye-opener to me. Mm-hmm. First of all, we were living in Chicago at the time.
Okay.
And in Chicago, things were crazy. I mean, housing prices were out of control. And we had friends that literally just walked away from their house, didn't even talk to the bank, literally just packed their stuff up, got another apartment to rent or move in with a family member, and just left their house.
Wow.
And took the hit on their credit. There were some crazy times. I remember tons of foreclosures. Yep. And then you're hearing on the news over and over again, these bank failures, Lehman Brothers and others. And I remember thinking to myself, what is going on? Like, how do banks fail? These banks are failing. And then I would hear things like, yeah, and the government's going to come bail them out. And I'm thinking, wait, how, really? How does the government bail out the banks? And of course, where does the money come from? Right? If the banks are failing because they're losing money. And then I started digging a little further and just learning. It just piqued my interest. And I found out a little bit about the Federal Reserve and how money was created in our country. And man, it just took me down a rabbit hole where I learned how money worked, the monetary system worked, our economy. So during that process, God really pricked my heart when it came to economics and understanding how the economy works. And then through that process too, God convicted me. I used to be of this mindset that there were two, I used to believe in the false dichotomy, basically, the sacred secular kind of thing, where you've got the corporate world, business world over here, where money's involved and it's greedy and people are doing sketchy things. They're probably compromising their faith and their values. And then you've got the ministry church side on the other side of the coin where, you know, real ministry is happening and real kingdom work is happening. And so the role of the corporate business guy is really to fund the work of the ministry where God is really at work. And this whole diving into economics and monetary kind of history and monetary policy, and then reading from scripture, looking at it all from a biblical worldview, I became convicted that that's not true at all. And that actually God calls us, his creation mandate, if you will, that we get in Genesis to create, to produce value and to be fruitful and to multiply, literally to take the raw materials that God has provided for us, arrange them and create things of value for others, was an entrepreneurial call. And so I started realizing as I'm reading the Bible that being productive in that way is being redemptive. And so business and commerce and enterprise, that's ministry every bit as much as church or parachurch organizations doing things, you know, nonprofits. And so I became very passionate about those people who were doing those things in the marketplace, having a redemptive impact in the marketplace. And then through various circumstances, when I was in Young Life, I was doing a lot of fundraising and working with the Chamber of Commerce. I got to know a lot of business owners and business leaders and seeing some of the things that they were doing locally, their heart for the community locally. I'd see those people. Then I'd also see the people who were stuck in the same false dichotomy that I had, who said, boy, I hate doing what I'm doing, but I make a lot of money, so I'm giving it to you and your ministry so that you can actually make a difference. Right. I remember ministering to these people and saying, no, wait, you have significant value in what you're doing in the marketplace. Then I became a pastor at Orchard Hill Church here in Pittsburgh, where I began to meet with a lot of men, because I was a men's pastor, men who owned businesses or were in the corporate world or were entrepreneurs. And I got a great deal of satisfaction and fulfillment, just encouraging them and helping them work through some of the issues that they were struggling with in their businesses from a biblical perspective. And I realized that I brought a certain perspective that they didn't have that really helped them. And so I realized that, okay, God, you're calling me, it seems, to something new, to this population specifically. And so Redemptive Economics was kind of birthed out of this digital course that I did during COVID for the men in our ministry at the church who were business owners and entrepreneurs. And I called it Redemptive Economics, a gospel-centered approach to business and entrepreneurship. And took them through all the things that I had been learning over those several years and just had a blast doing it. It was thrilling. And I got really positive feedback from them. That's kind of where it all started, I guess, at that point. And then ever since then, I've kind of tried to go where God is leading and calling me within that context.
Mike, that's a great overview of why this area is really pricking your heart and why you've invested a lot of energy in discovering why you should be doing things differently and why other people should be doing things differently when it comes to their economic output. Economic or economic? I say it both ways.
Yeah, you could say it both ways. Right. And you're touching on something actually that I'll just kind of clarify. I don't think I said this specifically in what I said up to this point. And that is that whatever we do as Christians, God is working out his redemptive purposes through our activities, including our economic activities, as insignificant or significant as they might be. So whether you are buying a pack of gum, whether you are saving for retirement, budgeting, coming up with your family budget, or planning for retirement, the type of money you use, all of these economic decisions, choreography that plays out in our lives, we either conflict with or contribute to God's redemptive purposes. And that's where my heart was pricked, as I mentioned, with the entrepreneurial call that God has placed on our hearts, that we are called to more than just, you know, be dependent on the nanny state or become a 9-to-5 wage slave. We're called to more. And when we do embrace that entrepreneurial call, it's one of the main ways I believe God calls us to have a redemptive impact.
I'm glad you said that. And I think I want to kind of drop a placeholder here so that we get back to this later. But you mentioned working with entrepreneurs and working with business owners. I've been a business owner with 3 or 4 other guys, so it wasn't just me alone. But I've been in that position, and it becomes very clear when you're running a business that a lot of people are depending on you, and so your decisions have an impact not just on yourself and your family, but on many other people.
Yeah.
And so with that mindset, I can see how making sure that your decisions have an impact for the kingdom, it's pretty clear how you can chart your path either in one direction or another. But I want to make sure that we cover how to approach this when you're not a business owner, when you're not an entrepreneur.
Mm.
Because,
yeah,
frankly, most people listening are not business owners or entrepreneurs, right? They can have that mindset, as you mentioned, but I want to make sure that we cover that before we get done. Because in reading on this and in listening to your previous podcast, it is clear that we all have a role to play in this, not just the people who are running businesses, but the mechanics of that may not be entirely clear to a lot of people. So I want to make sure that we cover that before we get done. But let's go back to the basics before we get into the details. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned redemptive economics a lot. Can you give us a definition or explain to people who are not real familiar with it? What do you mean when you say that?
First of all, I start with the premise that God, through his sovereign will and the power of the Holy Spirit, is accomplishing his redemptive purposes in and through our economic activity. Like I had said previously, no matter what it is, your business and entrepreneurial endeavors, how you spend and save money, how you handle debt, the type of money you use, all of it. So consequently, our role in that economic choreography either conflicts with or contributes to God's redemptive purposes. Therefore, for the Christian, redemptive economics means participating in productive economic activities that, number one, add value and contribute to human flourishing. Number two, reflect the materiality of God's kingdom. And number three, promote God's redemptive purposes. So that kind of last part is what I would submit as my definition, that we are participating in productive economic activities that I'd say follow those three main pieces: contribute to human flourishing, embrace the reality of God's kingdom, and promote God's redemptive purposes.
Okay, let's talk about this from how I invest my money, because that's something that everybody who's working, not just owning a business, but working in any capacity, wrestles with. How should I invest my money? And I'll give a quick example that struck me as I was prepping for this, which was my dad. So my dad started work in the 50s, worked until the 2000s, and then retired at that point. And he was a business owner for part of it, but for most of the time, he was working for the man, right? He was an HR rep in small manufacturing companies. But he instilled in me at an early age that it was important for me to invest everything that I could. So don't spend my money on things I don't need. plan for the future, invest my money. Now, when he started investing in the 50s and 60s, I don't know if mutual funds even existed. Maybe they did at that point. I haven't gone back and studied it, but he always started with investing in the company for which he was working. I think he always got stock in that company, but he was very careful to select the stocks that he put his money into. And he wasn't putting a lot of money in. I mean, this is a guy who had four kids at an early age, and we weren't scraping by, but we weren't living the high life. But he was very careful. He would research the companies and he would invest for the long term.
Yep.
Now, I don't know how much of this was based on his Christian principles, but this just made sense to him that I'm going to provide for my family, not just for myself, but for my family and for others by making good decisions about where I invest my money. I don't know how you would have operated today, because it seems like you said, when you went to the bank the first time, it's just like, okay, you're going to open an IRA. Here's your portfolio of mutual funds that you can invest in. Here's a couple that perform really well. Here's the numbers. Pick one, you know, or pick a couple and decide the percentages that you want to have. So how do we do that today when... Yes, you can invest in individual stocks, but you're really encouraged not to do that, right? You're encouraged just to, here's the high performers. Let me look at your risk profile. What's been your experience in dealing with redemptive economics, and how do you advise people, or what do you encourage them to do when they're looking to invest their money and they don't want to just do what everybody else does? Because some of the companies out there that you can invest in, some of the mutual funds, do not reflect your values.
Yeah, definitely. I love the story of your dad and his heart to be an active participant in his investments. And today, for several decades now, we're taught to do the opposite. We're taught, don't think, you're not smart enough. So give your money to someone who is, and let them steward it for you. And unfortunately, as Christians, we've abdicated our responsibility to be more proactive in what we're investing in. So most people don't have any idea what's in their portfolio. They have no idea the companies that are in there. And most of it is, I would say, companies that we're talking about, big companies that really the money they get there is in many ways the... Not that some of them don't provide value. Some of them really do provide value, but that becomes the lifeblood for them. Now, when you think about it, actually, when you look at the stock market, whether it's the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones or whatever, when you take it all in totality, I think if I remember correctly, at least in America, the last time I checked, there is somewhere in the neighborhood of 4,000-something publicly traded companies. I might be wrong on that. But it's definitely not more than thousands, okay, publicly traded companies. And that is the default that all the, I'm using air quotes, financial experts push us toward. And in doing so, we actually, I believe we miss out on the millions of other small businesses and companies, local businesses. We miss out on those. But what we've been taught is, no, that's too risky. You don't know enough. You're not knowledgeable. No, do put your money here. And I'll be honest, I think that, how do I say this? Not that our financial advisors are meaningfully trying to mislead us in some way. And like, no, I think they really believe that they're doing the best they can for us. But honestly, I don't believe it is. I think it's a disservice. I think we've been programmed kind of like cattle being ushered into the corral, all of us together going in the same direction, doing the same thing for the benefit of, if you will, the elite or those who are extra wealthy and have resources. And we've been in many ways just helping them more than we are ourselves. And there's a whole nother direction we could go in terms of talking about that. But man, I think the first thing to get out of this mindset that's the only place to put our money, because each of us have a wealth of knowledge within certain topics or disciplines based on our training growing up, our career, wherever we are, we have a certain wealth of knowledge. Every person does, based on gifts and talents and abilities too, what I call asymmetric knowledge. It's that knowledge that's like the unfair advantage, basically, depending on where you are. And so I personally believe that God has called us to leverage that in order to be fruitful and to multiply. And we do that, of course, maybe in our careers or the job we work in or whatever. But I believe that if we were to leverage our money and invest in those types of things that we already have a wealth of knowledge in, a couple things. Number one, you're mitigating your risk because you're knowledgeable in it, okay? And you're finding a niche that you have asymmetric knowledge about that others don't. So you can see opportunities within that realm that others wouldn't see. I always use the example of a nurse who decides to invest in a medical technology company because she sees the need for this in her everyday life. She understands the use of the technology, how it's used on the ground floor. And so she's able to leverage that knowledge, or he, could be a he nurse, they're able to leverage that knowledge to make, I think, smart, responsible financial decisions. When we look at Ecclesiastes, when he says to invest in eight different ventures, because you don't even know what is going to survive, work, and what's going to fail. They didn't have the stock market back then. There wasn't anything like that. And unfortunately, today, we've kind of misapplied that verse to, that's why we have a diversified portfolio in your mutual fund. Like, that's ridiculous. That is not what that verse is talking about. That verse is talking about investing in multiple ventures on your own in things that you know about or that you have relationships with and you trust or whatever. But again, we've been so, the mere thought of doing that, of pulling your investments out of the stock market, and I love this, paying the penalty, because it's a penalty. You're going to get penalized for taking your money out of the stock market. Why? Why do they word it that way? They word it that way because they don't want you to leave. Look, the stock market, if people were to do what I just advocated, what I just am describing, the thing would fall in on itself. It'd be a house of cards. Or it would have to be reorganized and used more productive ways, which I believe should happen. But we've been programmed not to do that. We've been told, no, you're not smart enough. Too much risk. Don't do that. You don't have the time. You need to focus on your own. And I think instead what we've done is we've become distracted with things. Like, it's not that we don't have the time. We're distracted like crazy with social media, with entertainment, with trying to be comfortable. Comfort and pleasure and hedonism. These things are rampant in our society. I think, honestly, if somebody really did want to take responsibility for their own financial future, that they could do the work and obtain the education needed to do this.
The Throwing Mountains podcast is part of the BiblicalLeadership.com podcast network. The vision of BiblicalLeadership.com is to lift up Christ, spread his word, and edify, encourage, and spark boldness in his servants around the world. The Bible is, of course, a guide to eternal life, but it's also a real-world guide to living, providing guidance on a broad range of topics, including marriage, parenting, faith, work, and leadership. The folks at BiblicalLeadership.com provide rich content and resources that help leaders use the Bible as a practical leadership manual every day. Be sure to check out BiblicalLeadership.com today.
And there are businesses locally that you don't need to be a venture capitalist. You don't need to be a wealthy investor. Some businesses only need $10,000 or $20,000, for example. Think about your local mechanic or plumber or HVAC guy. And in the process, enter in and utilize your knowledge to help in some way in that investment, because I believe you should be somewhat active in what you invest in. Leverage your unique talents, and maybe it's in marketing or sales, or maybe it's in design, or maybe it's in bookkeeping or accounting, whatever. There's so many aspects to business that you can help bring value to that business and help them grow, and you profit from it. I had a good buddy childhood friend of mine who walked into a t-shirt company, and this is in Wheeling, West Virginia, and the guy who owned it was about 80-some, just mentioned offhand that, yeah, he's probably going to be selling or shutting it down because he's going to retire. And George said, man, I might want to buy this myself. And so he went and got two other people, and they pulled money together, the three of them, to invest in this company and buy it themselves. And the, of course, the owner was thrilled because it was going to live on after him. He had invested a lot in it. He made some money in the process through them buying it, of course, where he could retire and move on, do something else. And they acquired a business, were able to leverage their unique wealth of knowledge and expertise to grow that business. And it has flourished since then because they bring new energy and new ideas and innovation to the business to grow it and make it profitable. Now, George decided at some point to be bought out, and he left that business, but made, I think it was 50 grand or something like that, with, I think maybe, I don't know, I want to say it was like a $10,000 investment or something on his part. I can't remember, but made a good return in 3 years, basically. The other guys are continuing on, and George is on to his next thing, but I wish more of us would have the faith in God to be able to go out and do that, because when we talk about having a redemptive impact in our communities, it's the small business owner, it's the entrepreneur who's on the local level, who's solving real problems that are impacting the community. And guess what? God wants us to be fruitful and to multiply, to be profitable in solving those issues. We've just become so fearful and addicted to comfort. And have decided not to do that. I think I answered your question. I know I went off a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, you did. And I really like how you ended your answer with the focus on your local community.
Absolutely.
Because the internet has brought a lot of changes in every aspect of our lives, including how we invest, the way financial markets work. I'm old enough to remember when, if you wanted to invest in stocks, you pretty much had to go to a broker or a financial advisor. Mm-hmm. It was very, very difficult to do it on your own. My dad would do it by buying individual stocks of companies that he was familiar with. I'm not sure exactly how he did it because I was too young. But when
that's impressive, because back then you didn't have Robinhood on your phone.
Right, exactly. And when I started working, I could get my own company stock. It went public. It was private until I had worked there a couple of years, then it went public. But getting other stocks was tough. You had to go to a quote expert for most things that you wanted to do. And now everything's different, and you can invest in whatever you want on your phone, like you said. Yeah. But none of that, or a minute portion of that, is local. If they're public companies, then they're usually a certain size. They've incorporated, probably not in your backyard, and there's a distance between you and these companies. I mean, it's rare that you invest in a company where you know people who are in upper management or on the board, something like that. But there's so many opportunities locally for you to get involved, like you said. I'll give you two quick examples from my own life. So when we started our company in 2006, we didn't need a lot of money. It was a tech company, but we needed a couple hundred thousand dollars. So I guess it's a fair amount.
Not a lot nowadays. People raising multi-millions
for a tech company. It was a pretty small tech company. Okay. And originally we expected two of our prospective customers to invest in the company for a percentage of ownership. Neither one came through. So we started going to banks, and we had been told that banks lend money to small businesses. So we found out that banks tend to lend money to organizations that don't really need the money, because they're in a position where to qualify for the loan, you have to have a lot of assets. And so we didn't have any. We were starting out. We didn't really have a product yet. We didn't have any customers. And they kept saying, well, let's see your portfolio of assets, and we didn't qualify. So we were based in Akron, Ohio. Only an Akron-based bank had enough faith in us to give us a loan, but three of the principals had to put second mortgages on our homes to qualify.
Yeah, I was going to say that's the other avenue is to mortgage your house or property or something, right?
And we were thankful because we finally got a line of credit to get the business off the ground. But it was pretty costly to get that. It put my own personal finances at risk for, I forget when that finally was removed. I think it was a couple of years.
Yep.
Whereas if we had had local folks who looked at our business plan confidentially and said, I really like what you're doing, can I invest? We would have made that happen. We would have given them a small share of the business and away we go. We did have one offer. One of the women who I had worked with at a previous employer ended up working for us. She and her husband ran a local sandwich shop. They still do. It's a family-run operation. It was several blocks from where we were setting up shop in this company. And they didn't have any money to invest in us. They were trying to keep their restaurant open. But they offered. They said, we can't offer you much, but anything we can do to help you guys out, we will, because they were local entrepreneurs and they saw we had somewhat of a relationship because we knew her. I didn't know her husband that well, but they offered. And there's got to be a lot of people out there who have some money to invest, who know you or they know somebody and you can get together. But we don't think that way. Like you said, we think I'll just invest in a mutual fund rather than having those conversations with local people who are trying to establish a business or who have a small business already and are in need of some funds.
Yeah, it's so relationally based. Your point in that is well taken. It is very much relationships.
Yeah,
sometimes we don't have the long-term perspective or the patience, because sometimes if you're not tied into the community like that, it's going to seem like, who am I going to get money from? Or what business could I invest in? Because I don't know any local small business owners. Well, there are definitely places out there to build those relationships, networking groups and things like that. Today, it's even easier with the internet to find folks who are looking for investors or looking to sell their business or whatever. But
if you don't know them, then can you trust them? That's the advantage, like you said, of the relationship. Because, there's a lot of people out there. But if I don't know you, if I haven't had a chance to really look at your business plan, I'm a little uncomfortable. Now, people do GoFundMe. Sure. There's all kinds of ways to raise money, like you said. The other thing I want to mention, and a lot of communities have this now, I'm sure Pittsburgh does, Akron does, they're all over the place, is these business incubators and accelerators. And that's a great way, most of them are open to having those conversations, facilitating those conversations. So you can go in and, you know, my expertise used to be in the software world. I've been out of it too long. But when I was in it, I did get involved in an Akron-based accelerator to mentor some of the entrepreneurs and to get involved with them, because a lot of them have great, great business ideas, but they need help. They need more than just investment. They need guidance. They need somebody to tell them that your business plan really is pretty weak over here. I think you should rethink this one aspect. Yep. And there's a need for people with that knowledge and expertise to come in, provide some guidance. There might be an opportunity for you to invest some of your money as well. But that's a great way locally to help out and to redeem, to provide some redemption for some of these folks who are putting it out there. They're trying to develop a business and you can help them.
And sometimes not having any knowledge can actually be an asset, because you look at it from a very fresh perspective and you can look in at a business or a process or whatever and say, wait, what about this? And would never have occurred to some people within that context of the business organization. So having little to no experience can actually be an asset.
Right.
But I just, in fact, today, just this morning, I interviewed this amazing guy, Andrew Ladusaw. He's a pastor and a business owner in Katanning, which is north of Pittsburgh. And it's one of those towns that was rug pulled by second order effect of the steel industry leaving, one of PPG's biggest glass companies or factories was up there. And it left around the same time that the steel industry left, and just left that city reeling up there. And so it's been depressed. People up there have been depressed. And this pastor really felt God call him to move there for the purpose of revitalizing the community and having a redemptive effect there. He had his own State Farm business, I guess. Mm-hmm. But he decided to buy an office building right in downtown Katanning. And this is so funny. He said, this is so funny. He said, everybody told him not to do that. They said, find an office in a location where everybody's going, because everybody's leaving Katanning, right, and they're going to some of the outskirts. Like, buy a building there or your business won't last. Well, he decided to do the opposite because he knew that God was calling him to revitalize Katanning. So he bought it right downtown in downtown Katanning. And then he started attending a church, and there was a church split. And he was part of the church split that went out because they were trying to take an entrepreneurial approach, really innovative approach to trying to impact the local community. And it just so happened he became an elder, and then the pastor left, and then they turned to him and said, would you be our pastor, basically? And he said, I guess, okay. So he became the pastor, but I love it. He does not take a paycheck. Mm. The church has no staff. It's completely volunteer-led and run. So he gets his income through his business and through other local investments. He's bought real estate and some office places downtown he invested in from the profits he had from his business. And then was very picky, in a sense, about who he would rent to, who he would bring into that space. He wanted them to have businesses that would be impactful in a positive way and have a long-term vision for the community. He said somebody came in and they wanted to put an arcade in, and then on the backside have it be a bunch of gambling slots and everything. And he said, no, sorry, you're not, no go. Because it's so funny. Something like that, most people would say, oh man, depressed area, put in some gambling slots, right, and we'll make a killing off of everybody's addiction to gambling and alcohol. They're already depressed. They're predisposed to that behavior. But he said no, and he has since rented to these great small businesses now that are doing great there. And then he has apartments in the upper side of it and everything. Oh, and then their church, they have worked with the town council and the people who are in charge of politics there, if you will, to literally revitalize the town. And so they've got a spreadsheet that they keep, and they work with the town council on this. The town council has kind of the worst of the worst things that's going to cost the most to fix a house or tear down a house, while the church has done their research and talked to neighbors and communities and found the places that they can come in and do projects, whether it be painting a house, rebuilding a porch or a garage or something. When they entered into this relationship with the town, the town council actually reached out to them because there was an elderly lady whose garage had collapsed. Mm. The roof had collapsed. It was so old. But she couldn't do anything about it, and she didn't have any money to get it fixed. And this councilman knew this, but he knew the church was out doing things. And so he contacted the church and, hey, would you guys be able to help her out? Because she's about to be fined. We're going to have to fine her, and I don't want to do that, you know? And so the church went out and put a team together, tore it down, and she was happy to have a space again, and everything was great. That's just a beautiful example of having a redemptive influence. And now he said, with the combined efforts of him, the town council, the Habitat for Humanity, and some other places up there, there's been like a very measurable 40% improvement on the economics of the town. There are ways, I guess, that they measure it that I don't totally know about. And it's all because they've decided to take this redemptive approach economically, entrepreneurially. Man, I just think, why are we outsourcing our resources, our capital, to these big conglomerate organizations, you know, big tech and big pharma and all this other? Why are we doing that as opposed to doing things like this where we're actually investing in the community locally? So my vision, my hope for what redemptive economics will do is have that impact on the Pittsburgh community. Katanning is one community, but there's also other depressed communities like Ambridge and Aliquippa and Homestead that were once like the industrial centers of the world.
Right.
Like literally, Homestead was one of the biggest, most productive steel plant that provided steel that literally built New York and the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge and Chicago and all the skyscrapers and infrastructure in our country. But now they're depressed. They have a self-defeatist kind of attitude, you know? And that's where I just believe that, especially Christian entrepreneurs, a multitude of them coming in. I mean, what a way to share the gospel, to have real impact, you know, in these communities.
A key partner for the Throwing Mountains podcast is the men's ministry CLC, Christ-Led Communities. CLC strives to build authentic community through the uncommon pursuit of Christ, and it has had an incredible impact on the lives of tens of thousands of men, including Mike Hatch and me. If you're like most men, then you have many male acquaintances, but few or even no trusted male friends. With CLC, you'll join with other men around the person and work of Jesus Christ, and powerful things will happen. You'll see masks removed and honest brotherhood begin. CLC is much more than a Bible study. It's a relational pathway that equips men for a lifetime of biblically based leadership. For more information, go to clchq.org or email Mike Hatch at mhatch@clchq.org. You know, the last couple of decades, I think, has accelerated this trend toward really not feeling a part of the community in which you live. I was commenting to somebody recently that local newspapers are going away. Growing up, our local paper was pretty poor, but, you know, it was the local paper. So it kind of unified us because everybody got the local paper, everybody read it, people wrote letters to the editor. It was our local paper. Mm-hmm. We've got construction going on in the community that I live in Ohio, and I have no real way of knowing what's being built there because we don't have a vibrant local paper. Mm-hmm. Where do you go for local news? There's still, quote, local TV channels, but they're not in my community, so they're not reporting on things like that. And I think we're kind of losing our identity as communities now. It's just where you live.
Yes.
You've got your house and you've got your neighborhood and you may like your neighbors, but is it really a community? Whereas when you are investing in or participating in activities that benefit your local community, that lift it up, it had its heyday and now it's become depressed, but you can be a part of redeeming that community. And its future is going to be different than its past, but it becomes more than a place that you live. It becomes truly a community where people are working together to build something up. Habitat for Humanity in Akron is doing something interesting, and this is a little tangential, but I'll mention it. Traditionally, Habitat, at least in Northeast Ohio, has gone into a neighborhood that's typically a depressed neighborhood, and they've built one house. So it plants a seed, right? There's a brand new house, and because there's a new house there, I think that the neighborhood benefits. People tend to take better care of their homes. But it's scattered. The effect is scattered because Akron's a big place, and there's a lot of neighborhoods, and you've got one new house here, and then maybe a mile away, there's another new house there. So it's somewhat of a dispersed impact. So recently, they've decided they're going to change their approach, and they're going to build a neighborhood. So they've got a couple of blocks, and they build not just one home, but over the course of time, they're going to build 16 or 20 homes in a matter of a couple of years. And really, it's amazing. Genius, because you're revitalizing not just a single home, but you're revitalizing an entire neighborhood, and that can grow and develop, becomes a destination for people to come into that neighborhood, that area. So, all right. So we've talked about, it started off with me asking about investment, and we've covered a couple different topics, but I think it's great because, again, this is not just people who own businesses or are starting a business, but this is anybody who's looking to invest, which is most of us. Let's talk about some other things that any of us can do. Let's talk about how we spend our money. What are some aspects of that that can get us into more redemptive economic activities?
Okay. One of the, I think, most misunderstood concepts for people in our culture in general, but also definitely for Christians, is the idea of what is money. And by virtue of that, what the Bible would describe as just weights and measures. So let's start with money first, because I think it's one of the most important concepts in it. We don't have nearly enough time to go into all the details, because money is a mind-blowingly deep thing to investigate. Most people wouldn't think so, but man, when you start thinking about the functions of money and how it's like the connective tissue that holds us together in many ways and helps an economy operate. And if we're dealing with unjust weights and measures, it can have a really, really corruptive, corrosive effect on our economy with all sorts of second, third order effects, like the steel industry leaving. That is a direct result. You can trace it back to 1971 and Nixon taking us off the gold standard and printing money like crazy. The dollar becomes very strong, and from a global perspective, and it just becomes unsustainable for these businesses to maintain, you know, paying the labor here in America. And so what happens? Well, they outsource it to somebody else who has a weaker currency, like China, of course, and others. And so we shoot ourselves in the foot when it comes to productivity based on whether our money is just or not. And so what I mean by that is, look, if our government in cahoots with banks, and really local banks too, and this will get to a more practical piece here soon, they contribute huge to the inflation of the currency supply, which translates to the inflation of prices, which of course right now we're in the midst of 2024. It's June 2024 right now, and inflation is still an issue, a big issue. We've come down since, I think, 2022 of like a high of 9%+ inflation, but it's still there. It's come down, but that measures the overall rate of inflation.
It's just not
going, right. It's just not going up as fast as it was before,
right.
But it's still going up,
right?
Which is why we're all motivated to put our money in the stock market, the dollar in the stock market, for example, because the stock market has been more about savings than it is investing. How do I keep from losing the value of my dollar that I'm earning? Well, if the government and banks wouldn't continue to print it at an unsustainable rate, which ultimately is stealing value from everybody else's dollar. So the minute somebody else prints more dollars, whether it be the Federal Reserve or your local bank through a loan, they're stealing value from your dollars or people who are already having dollars. And then what's worse is it's very systemic, where the upper echelon who are already wealthy, they tend to be a little closer to the quote unquote money printer. They get those dollars early before it matriculates through the rest of the economy and causes prices to go up. And so they take those dollars and they buy resources or assets like houses and real estate and tangible things. And it helps them to preserve their wealth. But those in the bottom socioeconomic rung don't have that opportunity. By the time they get the money, there's dollars sloshing around everywhere, and the prices have gone way up. Their wages aren't keeping up with the rate of inflation. And so they find themselves in a stuck situation where they can't do anything. So the first thing I would say is that I think one of the most redemptive things we can do as Christians is to not take out consumer debt. Now, this is a really, really difficult thing to say, because I'm standing in my house that I have a large mortgage on. And so I acknowledge, we talked about this a little bit with our interview with Jimmy Song, I am guilty. I've got blood on my hands, because I went to the bank to get this mortgage. And here's what happens when you get the mortgage, a car loan, a business loan, any loan that you take from the bank. It's not like the bank has the money sitting in a vault somewhere that they pull out and give to you when you get the loan. No, they have, through their charter with the Federal Reserve, they are allowed to print or type in to the computer extra zeros and numbers to manufacture that money. That money comes out of nowhere, okay? Literally. They pay an interest rate for that purpose to the Federal Reserve, and then the interest rate they charge you has to be more than the interest rate they're being charged by the Federal Reserve, and that's how they make their money. So this is crazy, but it's true. Your local banks contribute more to inflation, both the inflation of the currency supply and prices, than any other entity in the country. Okay? It's astounding. And so they get to print money out of nowhere, loan it to you in order to make a profit. that's mind-blowing to me. They didn't have to work for it. There's no effort to produce it. And here's the problem. In doing so, again, they're stealing value from everybody else who already has dollars. I mean, that is unjust weights and measures that the Bible talks about, okay? That is what God told Israel as he was setting them up as his people to take over the land of Canaan. You must have honest weights and measures. Because when you don't, and it's dishonest, you're basically stealing from other people, and it will corrupt your society, and it's corrupted us in ways we can't even imagine. So when you go, at least be cognizant of the fact that when you go to get a loan from the bank, I hate to say it, but you are stealing value from other people because that bank is creating it out of nowhere, okay? So that's why I think taking our money and investing it locally is incredibly redemptive because it counteracts that influence of the expansion of the currency supply. Instead, you are taking money that you have, that you've set aside, that you've saved, and using it to invest in a business versus creating it out of nowhere. Okay. So I think number one is we really have to start being careful. So for example, partly it's a Dave Ramsey thing, but we don't finance cars anymore. I buy used cars in cash because they're the worst investment anyway, right? We know all that.
Right.
Again, that's a way to avoid taking a loan from the bank and stealing value from other people and having inflationary effect on our economy and our culture. That's one of the first things. And then the second thing would be to have a mindset of being productive, not just being consumeristic. And this was a big shift for me. So I became very convicted just about how consumeristic I was. We are way too dependent on the quote unquote nanny state, the social entitlements that our government has kind of forced on us with Social Security, for example, are just out of control. And unfortunately, there's not a whole lot we can do about that right now. We have to pay our FICA or Social Security tax, all that. However, again, I think some people who work every day and work hard, they've got a lot of money stored in the stock market. And look, I'm not a financial advisor, so this is very dangerous. Don't take my advice. I'm telling you, actually, I'll tell you what I've done. I've taken my money out of the stock market. I have nothing in the market anymore. And I have decided to invest locally, both in my own business and in other businesses here locally. That's what I've decided to do. I think it's also smart to have other hedges against inflation, like gold or silver or like Bitcoin. You know, I'm a big Bitcoin proponent. And I'll just throw this out there. If anybody's interested, I am attending the Bitcoin conference, a Thank God for Bitcoin conference, which is a gathering of Christians who are missionaries and pastors from all over the world who are utilizing Bitcoin in redemptive ways, gathering together in Nashville. Man, you will learn so much about these economic things.
Mike, Bitcoin. When is that conference?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. That's July 23rd and 24th.
Okay.
And it's in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm going, folks. So come with me. And it's incredible to see the astute theology or the rigorous theology and doctrine that's employed in trying to understand Bitcoin in a redemptive way, from a biblical way. It's very compelling, but it takes some time because it's a deep subject. Money is a deep subject in general. And so I think for a lot of people, what's intimidating about it is, oh my gosh, I've got to work so hard at learning and understanding. Again, I realize they're young parents. I realize people are in very serious situations. But seriously, take inventory of your life. How much time are you spending on social media? How much time are you spending on being a consumer, whether it be of entertainment or otherwise, you probably have more time than you think. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. But it does take an investment of time and energy to learn more. So I'd say Bitcoin is a great thing. As I've viewed it and studied it, it is what I would call the only monetary technology that abides by God's mandate for just weights and measures. And when you look at the history over 15 years now, it is a bona fide asset. 15 years of proven results now. ETFs have been launched. Institutions, family offices are getting into it. It's legitimate. Okay. It's very legitimate. And there are some really productive, redemptive things that it's being used for. So I would say that's one thing to do. And I think I said be productive in general as well. Is that helpful?
Yeah. Yeah. What I like, Mike, is that with every question I've asked you, you've really focused on the strategic aspects, which I think is critical. Yeah, it is an investment of time. You've got to do research. You've got to pray about it. You've got to talk to other people. And you're going to make significant changes, if nowhere else than in your mindset, at least initially.
Yeah. And it's going to be hard.
Right.
Because, look, this is very countercultural.
Yes.
Clearly, it isn't lost on me that as I'm saying these things, I'm imagining people in their cars right now driving or sitting there listening to this, writhing in their seat, thinking, what is he talking about? Like, it's probably upsetting to some people because it is so counter. But we are sojourners. I think I say this in one of the episodes of the Redemptive Economics podcast. We are pilgrims in this world, in a hostile territory, Babylon, if you will, the dominant cultural influence, America. And so we're already at risk. We're already in danger just simply by being God's people in this. We've just had a duration of time where we've had the benefit of not being persecuted, basically. I think we need to gird our loins, man, and do the hard things to learn and grow and have a productive, redemptive impact.
But there are tactical things while you're reorienting yourself and while you're doing the research and while you're making plans to make some significant changes in how you approach these big financial decisions. There are some pretty easy tactical things you can do as well that are consistent, right? I'm thinking about my sister, who's always on my case about a variety of things, and justly so, rightly so. But she does all of her grocery shopping at a local Akron-based family-owned chain.
Loves.
And I don't, because, well, they charge more. I've got to break myself of this habit because her actions are more redemptive and more honorable than mine.
That's a great example.
They employ disabled people. They just do everything right, but they do charge more because it's tough being a local chain in this era of Walmart and everybody else who have the resources to offer things for 5% less. So you can shop local. You can go to locally owned and managed restaurants. There's all these simple steps you can take to start down this path. And I need to do that. I need to be more consistent in the little things while I'm getting out from under my own very large mortgage.
I hear you.
Because I've made the same mistakes, right? I was blissfully unaware of why my actions were, as we say in the tech world, suboptimal. But extracting myself from those previous bad decisions is going to be tough, like you said, and it's going to take time.
Yeah, it's going to take time, right. And you mentioned something great, too. As you go out and start visiting these local businesses and utilizing them, buying from them, you'll get to know them.
Yeah, talk to them.
Talk to them. Now you're starting to get into that network, if you will, of local businesses and building those relationships. And that can lead to all sorts of great opportunities.
Yeah. So I think we probably should wrap it up, but it's been a great conversation. I really appreciate your perspective on this topic, and I'm sure there are listeners do too. In closing, where are some places that we can go to get more knowledgeable about this topic, other than the podcast that you're developing and some of the resources that you provide? I mean, those are great, and we'll point people toward those, but what are some other places? The Thank God for Bitcoin conference in July in Nashville.
Yep.
What are some other things that I should be checking out?
Yeah, there is an amazing YouTube channel that I highly recommend, especially if you want to get a better, deeper idea of the corruption, the corrupt monetary system we find ourselves in. And it's called Hidden Secrets of Money. And Mike Maloney is the name of the guy who's the host of that show. And they've got a series of fantastic educational videos that are used sometimes in colleges and universities. That's a great one to go to. If people are into reading and learning more about, I would espouse the Austrian economic kind of school, if you will. You can go to, I think it's Mises.org. There is a ton of fantastic articles and books. Mises.org, Mises Institute, Austrian Economics, Freedom and Peace. Mises is M-I-S-E-S.
Okay.
If you want a real deep dive, there is tons of educational content there to help you understand. And then there are also some great books out there. There is a book called Biblical Economics. I don't know if it's still in print. I think it's still on Amazon, but it was the guy who founded Ligonier Ministries.
Mm.
What's his name? I'll give you the name once I find it in the show notes. But it was his son, actually. That book was a great starting point for me. And then lastly, I would say there's a great economist named Gary North, and he has GaryNorth.com.
Okay.
And the name of the website is actually Specific Answers, Wealth Building Strategies plus Q&A Forums. It was very helpful. Gary North's writing is phenomenal. I mean, it's super helpful. And there's all sorts of great ideas on there. I think they have a paywall to get into some of the chats and everything. The only thing I would say about Gary North is when I did pay to join that for a while. It was in that time where I was learning a lot and I wanted to figure out how to have a redemptive influence. And so I messaged in there several times. I said, hey, what do you guys do? How do we work to have an influence in our communities? And it was really disappointing because the response I got from the community was just protect yourself. The world's burning and you're not going to do anything to change people's minds. So just take care of yourself. So I just warn you, they're great resources, worth a visit, worth checking out. But unfortunately, sometimes that's the thought process of the community.
Right. Okay, excellent. Mike, well, this was a little different as we told people up front, but I think it was very beneficial. And I'm looking forward to your set of podcasts that you're developing. What's the expected launch date?
The launch date will be in September.
September.
Let me get to the specifics. It'll be a Wednesday, that first Wednesday, September 4th. Will be the official launch date of the podcast. So yeah, I'm grateful. Thank you, Chris, for this, for turning the tables and giving me the opportunity to share like this, man. I'm grateful. So appreciate you, brother.
You're a great host and a great guest.